when the child was born, every one of you, and even people who rarely come to church, would know what child I was talking about. Yet billions of children have come into the world, and only a handful have been remembered by name. So why should a Jewish child named Yeshua, born 2,000 years ago in one of the world's most out-of-the-way places, have been one of those who is remembered? Why is it true that more thoughts have been thought about that child and more love lavished on him and in his name than on anyone before or since? I'd like to approach an answer this morning from a completely different direction. Instead of talking about the Son of God born in Bethlehem on that memorable but undated night, I'd like to talk about two sons of God who were contemporaries and why it turned out that the name of one of them is now only a paragraph in books of ancient history, while the name of the other has been alive for 20 centuries and is spoken with reverence by more than a billion people on earth. On the night when this child was born, away from home and laid down for his first sleep in a crude shed, on that same night, far to the west across the great sea, a man called Augustus Caesar sat on the throne of the most amazing empire the world had ever seen. That world neither knew nor cared about a Jewish peasant child born in a small rural village and named Yeshua. But Augustus Caesar was the topic of talk from one end of the Mediterranean to the other, so that everything he did was magnified 1,000 times. Let's spend a biographical moment. This man's uncle had been the Roman Emperor Julius Caesar, the name Caesar being first a family name and later on a title. Much later, by the way, this kingly word Caesar would become in Russian Tsar, just as in German it would become Kaiser. When this Roman, Julius Caesar, was disappointed in not having a legitimate son, he chose his adopted nephew, Octavian, to succeed him. It turned out to be an inspired choice. Octavian would become the greatest statesman in Roman history. By the time little Yeshua was born, the one we know as Jesus, this man, Octavian, had enjoyed the world's admiration for years, and there is no hint that he could have heard of the birth of a child to an obscure couple in a far-off minor province of his empire. But even if by some incredible chance he had heard it, it would not have meant anything to him. He could know in some back corner of his mind that any male child born in turbulent Palestine might become a potential rebel against his power. But if someone had whispered to him that the greatest revolutionary in the history of the world had been born, he would have laughed. But there were some great ironies at work. Without realizing it, Octavian had been helping prepare the world for cataclysmic change. He had accepted a widespread belief that Rome, as an agent of the gods, was divinely destined to bring peace and goodwill to humanity, and that the man who sat on the Roman throne was a son of those gods, worthy to be worshipped. So he offered no objection when the Latin title of Augustus was given him by the Roman Senate. The word Augustus had been used before to name holy objects or places, but Octavian accepted it, and history has known him ever since, not by the name Octavian, but by his exalted title, Augustus. Intoxicated by praise, he petitioned to be called Divi Filius, Son of God, and the request was granted by the Senate. After all, Rome had serious enemies who threatened homeland security. What better way to save the empire than by having a god on the throne? So Augustus became God, the Son of God, and his birthday became a holy day. It all helped keep the superstitious masses under control. To rebel against the emperor would now be to rebel against God. We like money, so it didn't hurt when Augustus handed out the equivalent of tax rebates. One enthusiast even ran through the Roman streets, calling upon men and women to, quote, devote themselves to Augustus, by which he meant that they should promise to kill themselves when he died. In a frenzy of adoration, the Romans now gave him the supreme triumph. It was felt that the gods presided over time and had the right to give their names to the months. January, for example, belonged to Janus, the two-faced gateway god who looked back to the past and forward to the future. March belonged to Mars, the god of war. June honored Juno, queen of the gods. So the Senate met in solemn session and changed the name of what was then the sixth month, Sextilis, to August. And now everyone knew that this man, son of God and patron of a new month in the calendar, was the most important single man on earth and would never be forgotten. But in the strange and unpredictable ways of history, an unseen destiny began to move quietly in a far-off place, and a mystery began to take shape that would one day swallow up the empire that had swallowed up the rest of the world. A child grew in the womb of a carpenter's wife, a child who, without an army, would win the loyalties of billions of people in centuries to come. People who would never give a moment's thought to the man who had been born first Octavian, and then God, the Son of God, and Augustus, most magnificent of all the Caesars. And what a splendid irony that Augustus himself should be credited with having put the whole thing in motion. You heard the words Jim read a little while ago. It should have even more meaning to hear it once more. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus for a general registration or census throughout the Roman world. Everyone went to register in his own hometown. And so Joseph went from Nazareth to Bethlehem with Mary, who was promised in marriage to him. She was pregnant, and while they were in Bethlehem, the time came for her to deliver her baby. Because the Roman Son of God ordered a census, an all but invisible thread in the web of fate twitched. In the prose of history, hardly anyone would have noticed. But in the devotional poetry of Matthew, astrologers from the East come bearing gifts. And in the poetry of Luke, simple shepherds look wonderingly at the skies and hear celestial music. Both disciples are trying to suggest a fact too incredible for dull prose, that somehow the irresistible power of God and of love was in that helpless child, and that his first crying breath marked the beginning of a life that would eclipse all the Caesars, like sunrise fading out the stars. So now there were two sons of God on earth, one created by the Roman Senate, the other by a combination of Jewish prophecy and Christian faith. The goals of both sons of God were the same. Each was dedicated to the idea of universal peace, and each grew up believing it could come only as people surrendered to his sovereignty. Behind one of them was the mightiest military machine the world had ever seen, augmented by clever political and diplomatic skills, a kingdom woven of raw power and intrigue, obsessed with the thought of its own invincibility, convinced it was eternal. Behind the other Son of God was nothing grandiose at all, but so simple a growing up that we have only one small incident recorded from his childhood. Unaware of the great Augustus, except as a name before which Roman soldiers trembled in his occupied country, this child grew up in a small hill town, watching his father work with wood, smelling the clean shavings on the floor, taking walks in the lovely Galilean countryside, and listening sometimes to the elders as they read from their sacred books about a Messiah who would someday bring peace and dignity back to their people. At some point in his life, Yeshua, Jesus, became convinced of two things. First, that his people were wrong to look for a man of force and violence, because only love could win the world. And second, that because he felt the force of this idea so strongly in himself, he must himself be the Savior his people had waited for. So quietly and unobtrusively, when he was grown, he began to teach his friends the message of a love so persistent it could not be conquered, and would in the end conquer anything if we would only use it. He was laying the foundation for a radically different kind of kingdom. But since he had only 12 assistants, and even they were unimportant, no one paid much attention. As it turned out, he had very little time to spend with them anyway, and when he died by permission of the great Roman Empire, his dream seemed dead as well. How his friends reacted to his death, first by running away in terror, and then by becoming convinced that somehow he still lived among them, is a story you know so well, I need not repeat it. What's vital to my structure of contrasts this morning is that he had deliberately started a campaign to capture hearts and minds, not with soldiers, but with ideas. For a while, his ragtag followers seemed too trivial to upset anyone. But as more and more people enlisted, the establishment suddenly realized they were not dealing with a bunch of eccentrics after all. So they began to make arrests, helped by a Jewish fascist who thought, as fascists always do, that he was the only true patriot. So he jailed as many friends of Jesus as he could, and frightened the rest of them into scattering over the countryside. But it turned out to be like scattering sparks of live fire. Everywhere they went, they preached their message again, and another blaze sprang up. And then a second great irony happened. This fascist leader of a few Jewish stormtroopers, a man named Saul, had some sort of strange conversion experience in which he saw the face of love and gentleness, took a second look at the ugly face of violence in his own heart, and surrendered to the child who had become a man and died, but who also in some strange and wondrous way still lived in the hearts of his disciples. So Saul changed sides and changed his name to Paul. And since he had never done anything half-heartedly, he promptly became the captain of the new kingdom and took its charter everywhere. Up to now, Rome had paid no attention to such a small uprising. But then Roman soldiers in the dwarf province of Palestine began to complain that people were defecting to a different Son of God. And some of those soldiers even switched loyalties themselves. Worst of all, from Rome's point of view, the movement kept spreading. It crossed oceans and climbed mountains and leapt across whole countries. In Greece, far from their home in Palestine, Paul and a friend of his were arrested by a mob, yelling, "These are the men who have turned the world upside down and have now come here. What is more, all these men act against the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another king called Jesus." Another king. Even then, no one understood what a pivotal point that was in human history. Augustus had died in AD 14. Jesus had died a few years later, but each Son of God had let loose in the world his own philosophy. One designed to keep people under control by force, the other designed to love people so wisely they would wish above all things else to be like him. Well, we all know what happened. Roman society grew ever more restless and disillusioned. The richest began to sense that one's life was more than the things one can get, and the masses looked for an idea so compelling it would make life seem worth living again. So they were ready when the man named Paul came through their countries with word of a new kingdom of the Spirit, and after him still others, until one day in our final and perhaps greatest irony, an emperor of the same Rome that had worshipped Augustus declared Christianity the official religion of the state. It was one of the strangest reversals in all of history. Rome has been only a memory now for more than 1,500 years, while the new kingdom became a world religion. And the child whose birth we celebrate like no others won the distinction of having not a month named after him, but of changing the whole system of dating so that he would be honored every time people wrote B.C. for before Christ or Anno Domini for in the year of the Lord. Augustus would have found it all incredible. Did it happen because somewhere deep in us, forever being forgotten but forever rising again, there is a hunger for something the world cannot satisfy, a knowledge that to be forgiving and filled with love is not a weakness, but the ultimate strength. When I ponder why one Son of God has been remembered so well, while the other has been forgotten, I'm always led back to this, that when the child grew up and began to shape his kingdom, the title he liked best was not Son of God, but Son of Man. By which I think he was saying, no throne means anything at all unless a free and unfettered love puts one on it. One night, about 25 years ago, a group of carolers walked singing down Wichita's Douglas Avenue. They were joined by some surprised shoppers, and then they went into a bank building to sing Silent Night to a hushed audience. I was there, and not a single soul in that temple of glass and stone thought of the name of Augustus Caesar. But every one of them, from customers to bank president, knew why we were singing and what we were singing about that night when the other Son of God was born. I hope the contrast between the two ways of defining life we have considered this morning will enrich the meaning of this sacred season for every one of us.